There's no reason it should fall unless somebody pushes it. Okay. Good evening. I haven't said Ma'ariv yet, but I suppose that I can wish everybody a Chodesh Tov in any event. You know that there's a question whether or not the mitzvah of Simcha is restricted to the second month of Adar in a leap year, that is the month in which Purim falls, or whether there is a chiyuv of Simcha even during the first of the 2 months of Adar. So just to contribute, make my contribution to the resolution of that question and leave you guessing as to whether I'm serious about it or whether this is Purim Torah, there's a Mishnah in Masachet Megillah which discusses the differences between the 2 months of Adar. It says, Ein Bein Adar Rishon Adar Sheni Ela. It enumerates several differences. Simcha is not one of the differences which the Mishnah records. So, Michlala Vatashomea Hein. That if the Mishnah does not record Simcha as one of the differences between the 2 months of Adar, then we can assume that with respect to Simcha, the 2 months of Adar are equal. In any event, I hope that this month of Adar that we will be spending together will have not only the Simcha, which is born of the joy of the holiday of Purim, but perhaps some additional Simcha, which is drawn from the joy of learning Tanakh together. La Yehudim Haita Ora V'Simcha, and of course Ora, Oraita is Torah. So hopefully the joy of learning Torah will enhance the joy of the month of Adar in general and of the holiday of Purim in particular. What I'd like to begin doing this evening and carry on over the next several weeks is to take a new and a slightly different look at some old and favorite texts. That is, to use some of the more recent tools of biblical research to both to uncover new meaning in familiar texts, as well as to validate traditional meaning. Kind of like Yayin Yashan Bekankam Chadash. The tools of recent biblical scholarship, whether they are archaeology or comparative Semitics or literary criticism, are valuable tools. Like all tools, they are metaphysically parva. That is to say that archaeology is neither good nor bad per se. The results of archaeological discovery can be used or abused depending upon the person who is utilizing them. Hopefully we will be using some of these tools, as I said, both to reveal new facets of Torah, as well as to obtain, not that they need confirmation, but as I said, to validate the traditional interpretations. And the text that I've chosen to begin with is Bereshit Perek Kaf Gimel, the story of Abraham's acquisition of the Me'arat HaMachpelah. And there are, if you wish, there are Chumashim available, but if you have availed yourself of the three pages, the Xerox pages that are around, they certainly will be adequate in terms of the focus this evening. Just to remind you of the story, Sarah dies. I won't quite call the circumstances of her death mysterious, but certainly if we read the Midrash, those circumstances do take on a bit of mystery. There's that innuendo that somehow Sarah's death was not only subsequent to, but was actually a consequence of, the next nearest story in the Torah, namely the story of Akedat Yitzchak. And that, of course, is what enables the Chachamim in Seder Olam Rabbah, the standard work of Tanaitic chronology, and elsewhere, to establish certain relative dates in people's lives. Namely that if Sarah died as a consequence of the Akedah and she was 127 years old, and Yitzchak, and she was 90 years old when Yitzchak was born, then, ergo, Yitzchak was 37 years old at the time of the Akedah. Of course, that presents certain problems, at least to the Pshuto Shel Mikra. The idea that where it says that Abraham bound his son Yitzchak and placed him atop the wood which was atop the altar seems like a very, very difficult task to perform when you are lifting up a 37-year-old man and you yourself at this point in time are 137 years old. Right? It seems to be a somewhat easier task to imagine if Avraham is younger and Yitzchak is considerably smaller. Now, of course, the presumption that Yitzchak was 37 years old when his mother died, right, and the fact that he marries Rivka at the age of 40, is the basis for a subsequent assumption of the Agadah that Rivka was only 3 years old when she married Yitzchak, which again raises certain difficulties with regards to Pshuto Shel Mikra, since the activities which Rivka performs on behalf of Eliezer and his thirsty camels, of drawing water for 10 thirsty camels and the camel drivers and the caravaneers, etc., again seems to be a rather formidable task for a 3-year-old girl. It makes it a little easier to deal with if one does not necessarily assume that she was 3 years old at the time, but that she was older. Witness also the fact that the text itself, in the parak which is subsequent to the one that we're going to study this evening, refers to her consistently as the Na'ara, whereas a 3-year-old girl would hardly qualify as a Na'ara. Well, that depends on a judgment that I'm not capable of making, but I rely here on the second-hand testimony of Nechama Leibovitz, who once told me that she happened to be in Be'er Sheva teaching a class, and there in Be'er Sheva she made the acquaintance of somebody on the faculty of the University of the Negev who specialized in Bedouin life. She had him investigate the question based upon the assumption of the traditional size of water pitchers and the amount and the volume of water that would be required in order to satisfy quench the thirst of 10 camels who had made the journey from Be'er Sheva to Haran. He then calculated for her exactly how many times Rivka would have had to go to the well in order to do it. I don't remember exactly what the statistics are, but anyway. Anything is possible, but hardly likely. Okay. In any event, the story that we're dealing with this evening is the prelude to that story, mainly of how Avraham, subsequent to the death of Sarah, acquires what he considers to be a suitable site for her burial. And the text seems to be reasonably straightforward, save, of course, for several very, very significant questions which arise pertaining to the story. Number one, why does the Torah attend at all to the particulars of Sarah's death and burial? When Avraham dies, it says, Avraham died at the age of blank and was buried by his sons Isaac and Ishmael. Why then does the Torah not simply say, Sarah died at the age of 127 and was buried by Avraham? And even if you want to tell me that it is significant to note the site of her burial, so just extend the verse and say, Sarah died at the age of 127, and she was buried by Avraham in the Ma'arat HaMachpelah in Kiryat Arba HaHevron. And even if you want to tell me that it is significant to note not only the site in which Sarah was buried, but to note that it was obtained by Avraham through purchase from a local inhabitant. So extend the pasuk just one bit further and say, Sarah died at the age of 127, and she was buried by Abraham, her husband, in the Me'arat HaMachpelah in Kiryat Arba, which Abraham acquired in purchase from Ekron HaChiti. And as a matter of fact, exactly. It's precisely what we want to determine. There's a rule of thumb by which we operate in the study of Torah. The rule of thumb is, different names by which it's known. I prefer big words. When I was in high school, right here in Brooklyn, we used to call them SAP words. It's the law of parsimony. That is, the Torah is generally assumed to be somewhat parsimonious in its use of words. If there is an assumption that some people have, that there is not even an extra letter in the Torah, then of course you can learn a kal vachomer that there are no extra words. Therefore, whenever the Torah seems to be indulging extra extraneous things, naturally we assume that these matters are of great significance. And it's precisely one of the points that we're going to determine. Why, in fact, does the Torah attend to all of these particulars? As I said, why not just have one pasuk, Vatamot Sarah, what do you want to say? Vayuchaye Sarah Me'ah Shana V'Shim Shana V'Sheva Shanim, Vatamot Sarah V'Kiryat Arba, Vayikbor Ota Avraham B'Marat HaMachpelah Asher Kana Me'et V'Neichet. As a matter of fact, effectively, the Torah pretty much does something like that. In effect, Psukim Yod Zayin Yod Chet at the end of Perek Kaf Gimel essentially restate the whole previous story in a reasonably concise fashion. Right? It determines that the field which had belonged to Ephron, which was located in Mamre, was obtained by Avraham in the presence of all of the Hittites, and there he buried Sarah. So you have, in fact, in the parlance of the yeshiva world is called a mimonapsha. That is to say, it gets you coming and going. Either have the details in a reasonably concise form, as they in fact appear in the last four psukim of this perek, right? Or elaborate on them to your heart's desire, as the Torah does in the first 16 psukim of this parak. But why do we need it both ways? Secondly, why pay so much attention to the details of the negotiations which Avraham conducted with the B'nai Chait in general and with Ephron in particular? Why not just summarize them? Why do we have what appears to be almost a verbatim transcript of the negotiation? Third, regarding those negotiations, why does Avraham spend time negotiating with the Nechait, with the Hittites in general, when eventually he has to negotiate one-on-one with Ephron, who was the owner of the field he wanted to obtain? Well, obviously every question has an answer. At the moment, I just want to stipulate the parameters of the inquiry. Secondly, let's look for a moment at the Hittites in general and at Ephron in particular. Is the impression that you get by reading the text that they are being very sincere in the conduct of their negotiations with Abraham? Or do you get the impression when you read the text that they are being very shrewd in the conduct of their negotiations? When Avraham pays 400 shekel kesef to the Me'arat HaMachpelah, do we sit here and do we say, attaboy Avraham, you got him? Or do we sit here and do we say, boy, did they take him? What impression is the text? Now, the text is clearly and deliberately trying to convey an impression. which of the two impressions remains to be seen. It also remains to be seen whether we have any ancient evidence, any evidence which would enable us to determine whether 400 shekel kesef for marat hamachpelah is a reasonable price or an unreasonable one. And finally, all of these details, whether they are of a legalistic nature or whether they are of a financial nature, are they merely of historical importance, or do they have some significance which transcends the historical? Then, as I said, this is basically the outline of the inquiry. Why is so much attention lavished on the burial of Sarah? Why all of the details concerning the negotiations? Why are the negotiations themselves conducted in what conveys to us an impression of being not entirely straight? Why are all of these details, which the Torah clearly felt are pertinent enough to relate them, are they here merely to satisfy our historical curiosity? Or do we not assume that the Torah is not interested in satisfying only historical curiosity, but that anything mentioned in the Torah, of course, is historical, but that it is mentioned on account of a significance which transcends its immediate historical significance? Okay, where do we start? We should start by reading the text. Now, I don't want to read through the whole text on account of the constraints of time. So what I want to do instead is just read a portion of the text, and that's the portion of the text that I placed here on the first of the Xerox pages. And in fact, I even put a little preface to the text showing the literary structure of the chapter. And you can read the note. The literary structure of the chapter is designed to accommodate the negotiations of Abraham, Bnei Chet, and Ephron as follows. It begins with the first three psukim are simply a background stipulating Sarah's death. Then you see that there are alternating sections. Notice that it doesn't read down, it reads across. B, and adjacent to B is C, meaning Pasuk Balit contains Abraham's opening address, and the next item is C, Sukim Hay and Vav, which contain the Hittites' opening response to Abraham. And then, Sukim Zion through Ted, Abraham speaks a second time. Sukim Yod and Yod Aleph, Ephron replies. Then, Sukim Yod Bet Yod Gimel, Abraham makes a third speech. And that's followed in Yod Dalad and Tet Vav, again by a response on the part of Ephron. So that, notice, the literary structure is one which, as I said, suggests negotiation. Because what you have is point, counterpoint. Point, counterpoint. Not a summary. The Torah could have done that too. If the Torah's only purpose were to provide the details, it would have done so in a different literary fashion. It could have narrated all of the details. It could have said, Abraham wanted to purchase a sadeh from the Chitim, so he went and he spoke to the Chitim, and then he spoke to Ephron, and he obtained from the Chitim and from the Ephron permission to buy a field, and he paid 400 shekel kesef for it, and the Chitim even wanted to give it to him for free, and they offered it to him as a achuzat kever, as a burial site to be used in perpetuity, but he preferred to buy it. Now we'd have all the details there. All the details would be there. What would we be missing? What we would be missing is this sense, this vivid sense of a negotiation being conducted, as it were, before our very eyes. Abraham speaks, the Chitim answer. Abraham speaks again, the Chitim answer. Abraham speaks a third time, the Chitim answer. And then the balance of the Perek are, in fact, the details which we noted at the beginning are really all the information that we really need for this story. The sale was concluded, the results of the sale, return to the background, a synopsis, done. Now, here, on the bottom of the page, I have taken items B through G, that is to say, the point and counterpoint, and I've provided little snippets of the text of those sections in order to show that not only is there a literary point and counterpoint, but there is an actual linguistic point and counterpoint. It isn't only that the Torah says Avraham spoke and then the Chittim answered. Avraham spoke again and the Chittim answered. But notice how the Chittim reply to Avraham appropriately with respect to the language Avraham uses to make his overtures to them. So that Pasuk Dalet, right, which is Avraham's first speech, Avraham declares himself to be a ger v'toshav, and he requests of the Chittim, tnu li achuzat kever, right, provide me with a burial vault, that rameti milafanai, so that I can inter my wife. Now notice, in Pasuk Vav, right adjacent to it, which comprises the response of the Chittim, notice that they are responding to Avraham point for point. He began by declaring himself to be a ger v'toshav, a stranger in their midst, and they respond by saying, oh no sir, you are a Nesi Elohim. Right? Don't belittle yourself. Don't belittle yourself. You know, there's a story about the Chafetz Chaim. It's very hard, because I don't know if he would have recognized himself if he would have been referred to as the Chafetz Chaim as opposed to being referred to as the Chafetz Chaim. But there's a story that the Chafetz Chaim was once on the train going home to Rabin. And there was a yeshiva bacher there who saw an elderly Jew going to Rabin and started quickly to ply him with questions about the Chafetz Chaim. Is he really such a big Talmid Chacham? Is he really such a big tzaddik? And of course the Chafetz Chaim, yeah, he's not such a big Talmid Chacham, he's not such a big tzaddik. And this young man got very, very angry and upset that this elderly man was putting down the Chafetz Chaim. So apparently he hit him or something. I mean, he just got physical. Then, of course, the train pulls into Rabin, and there's a whole delegation waiting there to greet the Chafetz Chaim. And when the young man realizes who he had, you know, been arguing with, you know, he stood there wishing that the ground would open up and swallow him. So, of course, he came to the Chafetz Chaim later and tried to beg his forgiveness for having, you know, insulted him and having, you know, hit him. And the Chafetz Chaim characteristically stopped the young man and said, no, he said, you taught me a very important lesson. What lesson did the young man talk to Chafetz Chaim? The lesson was that you're not allowed to say Lashon Hara even about yourself. Okay. Anyway, I was just apropos of the fact that Avraham had called himself a ger v'toshav, just a stranger, and the Chittim, you know, pulled him up and they said, no, don't, you know, you are in the Nesi Elohim. Now, Avraham should be encouraged by this, shouldn't he? It should be much easier to obtain what you want if you have a high standing in the community than to obtain what you want if you have no standing in the community. Raising, of course, the question of, didn't Avraham Avinu know the lesson of the Chafetz Chaim? In any event, why does Avraham Avinu begin by declaring himself to be a ger v'toshav? Why is he putting himself at what appears to be a disadvantage? Didn't Avraham know that he was regarded as a Nesi Elohim? Why didn't Avraham? Well, sure he knew. Sure he knew. After all, where is all this taking place? Hebron, a.k.a. Kiryat Arba, which is what? Have we ever come across this place or anything relating to it before in Sefer Bereishit? It belongs to the clan called Mamre. You remember Mamre from Perek Yod Dalet. You remember that Mamre was one of the Baalei Brit Avraham, right? There's no doubt but that Avraham had a long-standing relationship with the people of Mamre, and there's no doubt but that Avraham knew that he was regarded by them as a Nasi Elohim. In which case, why does Avraham not simply come in and say, I'm a Nasi Elohim, I want an Achuzat Kever? Who's going to say no to a Nasi Elohim? Why does he appear to put himself at a disadvantage by walking in and effectively admitting, I have no standing in this community, right? I'm begging you, I want an Achuzat Kever. Okay. Avraham then speaks again in Pasuk Chet, and he says, in Yeshet Nafshechem Likboret Metim Milafanai, right, that if indeed you will grant my wish and enable me to inter my wife, he says, Shema'uni, right, listen up, Ufiga'uni be'efron ben soha. The word that I have accented is Shema'uni. And adjacent to it, in the response of Ephraim, he says, Adolo Adoni Shema'oni. Avraham says, listen up. Ephraim says, no, now you listen. Avraham speaks again in Pasuk Tet, and he says to Ephraim, he's still speaking indirectly, V'yiten li et me'arat ha-machpelah, V'chesef male yitnen nali, emphasizing the word late, naton. And notice that Ephron responds in kind with the threefold use of the verb late. Hasade natatila, hame'arasha bolacha nitatiha, le'inev ne'ami nitatiha la. What does natati ordinarily mean? Does it mean to sell? Or does it mean to give as a gift? Is Ephraim here really saying, I don't want any money? Notice Avraham is somewhat ambiguous. He says, the yitenli, right? Would you please approach Ephraim on my behalf and have him give me the ma'arat ha-machpelah? And then almost in the same breath, as though he realizes that he might have made a faux pas, by what right does he expect the ma'arat to be given to him, he says, I meant the kesef male yitnen nali. I didn't mean the nitina, which is gratis. Right? I meant, of course, the nitina, which is preceded by a payment. So when Ephron replies and says, natati, 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 is he responding to Avraham's opening natati, it's yours, a gift? Or is he responding to Avraham's closing natati, which is the natati which is a consequence of kesef malei? Avraham speaks a third time in Pasuk Yod Gimel, saying now directly to Ephron, imata lu shema'eni. He originally said shema'uni to the bnei chet in general. Now he says shema'eni directly to Ephron. And he now makes it perfectly clear that he says, Natati kesef hasadeh. Right? And Ephron replies in Pasuk Tevav, saying, no, again, you listen to me, Adoni shema'eni. And indeed, Pasuk Tetzayim, which ends the negotiations, Avraham indeed, Vayishma Avraham el Ephron. Now, as I said, not only is this an excellent illustration of the point-counterpoint nature of the literary structure, how it embodies the notion of negotiation, but there are several very interesting linguistic features here. For example, B'nei Chet is repeated 8 times in this parak. Ordinarily, we expect the Torah to introduce the B'nei Chet and then to refer to them with the personal pronoun of Haim. Right? 8 times B'nei Chet, and if that were not enough, 3 additional times there are references to Am Ha'aretz. Who are the Am Ha'aretz if not the B'nei Chet? And 2 more times, there are references to Kol Ba'ei Sha'ar Iro. don't understand. Who are the B'nai Chayt if not the Am Ha'aretz? And who are the Am Ha'aretz and the B'nai Chayt exclusive of Kol Ba'ei Sha'ari Ro'? And why does it require, in 16 Psukim, 13 specific references to the local inhabitants? Look at the verbs. The verb naton, non tav non, appears even where we have it here. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 times. The verb shama appears 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 times. 5 that you see here, and again, 6 times. The verb kum, vayakum Avraham. The verb kum appears 5 times. Why this proliferation of verbs? Now the verb kum is a verb of action. Right? It's significant to have in the negotiation. We want to know, was there a pace to the negotiations? Was it were the negotiations following the same pace as the negotiations to settle the baseball strike? Meaning, were they protracted negotiations? Or were they negotiations which were conducted under some sort of a deadline where you imagine that the two sides are trying as quickly as possible to come to an agreement? We spoke about the ambiguity inherent in the term naton. When does it mean a gift? When does it mean a purchase? And the verb lishmoa. When does it only mean listen up? When does it mean not only to listen, but when does it imply consent? When it says at the very last line here, Vayishma Avraham el Efron, Vayishkol Avraham le Efron et HaKesef, there it clearly doesn't only mean that Avraham in the physical sense heard what Efron had to say, but it means that Avraham acquiesced. Avraham accepted Efron's condition. Okay. Now, here's where we start. Up until now, we've really done nothing but make observations based on the text. We haven't offered a word of interpretation or of clarification. We've just simply, as I said, defined the parameters of the problem. What is the overall effect of the text? We said that the structure of the text embodies the notion of negotiations. You speak and then you answer. You speak and then you answer. You speak and then you answer. Is that a realistic description of what you imagine went on? If it is, then it qualifies for a term which is used by literary critics, namely that it is mimetic. That is in the word mime. Right? Mimetic, or to use the noun form, mimesis. That is to say, the representation or the reflectional representation of reality in literature. What you have here is a thoroughly mimetic text. It is an actual reproduction of the reality, showing the negotiation in stages, making the speeches long, stilted, and full of unnecessary protestations, repeating the word listen over and over again, having Avraham bow down twice to his partners in the negotiation, and making the approach of both parties indirect. Again, I don't presume certainly in this audience to be possessed of a singular knowledge of how negotiations are conducted in the Near East, because with respect to the conduct of negotiations, not much has changed since the time of Avraham Avinu. I know from my own experience of shopping in bazaars in several Middle Eastern countries, that you walk in and you try very hard not to show particular interest in what you really want. Because the more interest you show in what you really want, then of course the higher the price will go. So you ask about something that you have no interest at all in buying, and you try to get a, oh, how much is this? You know, like, you know, who really cares? Now, the response in a traditional Middle Eastern bazaar, the response generally tends to be very flattering. The response to be, and I've heard this, and I know that they don't mean it because I once tried to take somebody up on it and I found out how quickly he changed his mind. The response was, for you, sir, nothing. Right? You are my first customer today, it is tradition, for you, sir, nothing. Right? Meaning, it starts off very formal. And it starts off with great protestations of friendship and of honor on both sides. Eventually, by the time it's over, right, not only have you paid, right, full price for whatever you get, but when you try to pay with your American Express card, what do you find out? We don't honor American Express, cash. Right? Now, what did we just read now, if not a very, very typical bargaining session, which could transpire almost any day in any Middle Eastern souk? Right? Abraham comes in, and he makes his first formal opening statement, and the Bnei Chet respond with their formal opening statement, then the negotiations start. Abraham sets out his position, there's a response. Abraham ameliorates his position, the other side ameliorates their position. And when it's all over, not only does Abraham pay Abameo Shekel Kesef, but he pays Over La Socher. Now, we could stop right here, and we could answer all of both the general and particular questions that we asked. Why all of the attention lavished on the circumstances surrounding the burial of Sarah? Why the protracted details of the negotiations? Why the literary structure? Why the linguistic point and counterpoint? We could answer it all right now by saying the Torah wanted to give us a slice of ancient Near Eastern life. Right? To let us know that the Avot did not only transact business with God and with angels, right? But to give us an illustration of how our Avot transacted business with ordinary people. After all, they are our Avot for one of many reasons being because we are encouraged to emulate them. Ma'aseh Avot, Siman Rabbanim. Right? I know Ramban says that in a historiographical sense of providing a philosophy of Jewish history. But in a sense, they are commended to us as role models. So if we want to know how to talk to God, Vakasha, let's see how Abraham spoke to God. If we want to know how to deal with Malachim, let's see how Abraham dealt with Malachim. We would be at a great loss if we could not look to our Avot for a shining example of how to conduct business with our fellow men. Therefore, the story is here, not necessarily for any greater purpose than to just simply tell us, this is how business was conducted in those days, and look how Abraham Avinu conducted business. He came in, he didn't come in and say, I'm an Asi Elohim, Magi Ali, I deserve it. He came in and he said, I want to be sure that nobody here will say that I took advantage of them. Therefore, deal with me as you would with a ger toshav. Right? I want this, I want you all to agree to it, I will pay for it, and here we have a wonderful example of how to conduct business with our fellow men.
Gave it in his way, as opposed to Get me on another evening, and I'll spend the whole evening discussing a relatively obscure and definitely ambivalent line in the Midrash Shemot Rabbah, which, apropos of the pasuk where Paro says, "Tichbad ha'avodah al hanashim va'al yisha'u b'divrei shaker," picking up on the word Yisha'u, the Midrash says, "Melamed shayu bidehem migilot shayu mishta'ashim bahem me'erev Shabbat la'erev Shabbat." And I'll be delighted to spend an evening discussing the possibilities of what were contained in those migilot, which our ancestors are reported to have had in Egypt considerably before the Torah was given. Right now, I don't want to make any such assumption. Okay. No, not at all. I just don't want to be drawn into that. It is certainly germane to the discussion, but not necessarily relevant. Come now to the second of those, of the three pages, the one which is a Xerox page from the Torat Chaim, the Neo Mikraot Gedolot of the Mossad Arad Kork Publishing Company. Look with me into two of the commentaries here in particular. First, on the left-hand side, the commentary of Rabbi Avraham ben Ezra. This commentary is contained in Pasuk Yod Tet, the very end of the story. Ibn Ezra says on the second line, "V'nizkira zot ha-parasha." Here, Ibn Ezra is responding not to any of the specific details of the story, but rather to the general, to the total complexion of the story, and to the need the Torah obviously felt to tell us the story, and the whole story. V'nizkira zot ha-parasha. Why? Lehodi'a ma'alat eretz Yisrael al kol ha'aratzot lachayim v'lametim. Why this whole story, says Ibn Ezra? In order to inform us of the advantage which Eretz Yisrael provides beyond that of any other land, both for the living as well as for the deceased. And furthermore, he says, Va'od, and moreover, Lekayein Devar Hashem La'Avraham Lehiot Lo Nachala. That this indeed provides us with the first actual, tangible illustration of the fulfillment of God's promise to Abraham that this land would be his and he would be able to bequeath it to his descendants. Okay? In fact, what Ibn Ezra may have had in mind, a source that he might either have referred to deliberately or otherwise, is a midrash in Bereshit Rabbah. Amar Rabbi Yudan Bar Simon, you don't have the text of this, Zehad mishlosha mekonot she'en umot ha'olam yicholim lehonot et Yisrael lomar gizulim hem b'yedechem. That the details are provided, all the details here are provided, so that this shall constitute one of the three places concerning which Gentiles cannot accuse Israel of theft. After all, Abraham negotiated the sale, Abraham paid for it, it became his legal possession, and therefore, say what you will about the Jewish possession of other places in the land of Israel, but the Ma'arat HaMachpelah is ours, signed and sealed. Of course, the Midrash refers to three such places, and of course those are the three places which were actually obtained, purchased. Right? Ma'arat HaMachpelah was the first. The second is? Well, that was the third. And not all of Yerushalayim, of course, only the Goren of Aravna HaYivusi. The second, of course, is the Sadeh in Shechem, which Yaakov bought. Right? Yaakov bought a Sadeh from Shechem for Meyak Sita, Right? And therefore, these constitute three places which the Midrash Bereshit Rabbah says, or at least three places about which the Gentiles cannot level against us the accusation that we stole it or that we took it only by force of arms. Clearly it is ours. We paid for it. Okay. Don't bother trying to enter this into evidence in the United Nations, but notice nevertheless either the symmetry or irony of history. What are the three places, or certainly three of the five places, which are the sorest sticking points in any kind of settlement or attempt at rapprochement between Israel and its present-day Canaanite neighbors? Ma'arat HaMachpelah, the Sadeim Shechem, and the Goren of Aravna HaYivusi. And we'll have a little more to say about that later. Now on the right-hand side of the page, on the bottom, Ramban. Don't try to find this in your edition of the Torah Chaim. I snipped the Ramban out from the following page and pasted it in here. Just, you know, it's part of my Imitati Odei. If HaKadosh Baruch Hu is Chasam Amonam Shel Yisrael, so why Xerox two pages if with a little scissor and paste I can get away with Xeroxing only one? Okay? Towards the bottom of the page, a little below the middle of the column of Ramban, the third word in where he starts, the Nichtava Zot HaParasha. Ramban, in fact, deduces not one, not two, but either three or four explanations for the Torah's lavishing of such detail. Okay. I chose to focus on these two, but there are considerably more. One in particular that I want to bring to your attention is Saadia Gaon. Saadia Gaon deals not just with the question in general of why and all the details provided here, but he deals with one very subtle point of it, namely, why does Abraham have to negotiate the sale both with Ephron as well as with the Bnei Chayt? Now we're beginning to even answer the question that we posed of why is it necessary to mention the Bnei Chayt so often, and not only the Bnei Chayt eight times over, but three additional references to Am Haaretz and two additional references even beyond that to Kol Ba'ei Sha'arira. The answer, says Saadia Gaon, lies in the Gemara in Bava Batra. It lies, in fact, in the halachic prerogatives of neighbors. The technical term for the halacha is bar mitzra. Bar mitzra means someone whose land adjoins yours, a neighbor. And according to the halacha, there are certain limits to what you are allowed to do on your own land. If in fact the consequences of what you do on your land will necessarily, realistically, impinge upon your neighbor's rights. And therefore your neighbor, as a bar mitzra, can in fact veto what you want to do on your own land. For example, you cannot set up a tannery on your own land without the consent of your downwind neighbors, because inevitably, right, the smell of the tannery is going to go downwind and will be offensive to him. Therefore, he has the halachic right to veto your plans to build a tannery. Says Saadia Gaon, it's very interesting, as though he assumes that the laws of Bar Mitzra are such commonsensical laws that every decent society would have abided by them or some form of them. Who wants to live next door to a cemetery? Think of what it does to real estate values. Therefore, before Ephron could consent to selling the Ma'arat HaMachpelah to Abraham, who would transform it into a burial ground, he had to obtain the permission of either the immediate neighbors, or again, to inject a contemporary note,
he had to appeal to the city council because it required a variance. Now, that's very interesting. In fact, it sounds quite, again, to use the Arabic term, it sounds moderna. It's a very modern kind of an interpretation. By the way, you know that Saadia Gaon is the medieval Jewish philosopher who first introduced to us the division of mitzvot into mitzvot sichliot and mitzvot shim'iyot. And by sichliot, he meant mitzvot. That's a hard term, because if you call one category rational mitzvot, there's an unfortunate tendency to refer to the other category as not rational mitzvot. And Saadia certainly didn't mean that. What he meant is that there are certain mitzvot of the Torah which reason alone would commend, whereas other mitzvot of the Torah are equally rational and reasonable, but reason alone would not necessarily perceive them. Therefore, the idea that bar mitzvah is in fact one of those mitzvot sichliot, that it is in fact a kind of a circumstance or a situation which is commended by logic and by reason. Of course, a good society wants to maintain cordial relationships amongst neighbors. The interesting thing is that if we go a little bit beyond Saadia Gaon, backwards, into the ancient Near East, we not only discover that Saadia was basically on target, but he also unlocks the mystery of why Avraham did not simply stipulate that he was a Nasi Elohim and was entitled to an Achuzat Keva, but why in fact Avraham introduced himself as a Ger V'Toshav, the Chafetz Chaim notwithstanding. What we learn, and we don't know as much about Hittite law as we would like to, and we certainly do not know nearly enough either about Hittite law or about real estate transactions in the ancient Near East to answer the question of whether Abamiyot Shekel Kesef is a steal or being robbed blind, right? That still is an open question that will depend on, as I said, on how the story speaks to you. Does it speak of sincerity on the part of the Hittites, or does it speak of shrewdness on their part? But what we do know is sufficient to tell us that land was treated differently than property, and that whereas property was transacted solely on the basis of value and of supply and demand, land was held in different and higher regard. We know that from biblical society too. Remember the response of Navot to King Ahab, when Ahab, the king, right, wanted to buy the kerem of Navot, right, of Navot HaYisraeli. What did Navot say to him in response? Chalilali. He said, what is that? Part with my ancestral land? Part with something that has been in the possession of my family for generations? So that land was considered differently from the consideration which was given to movable property. Therefore, land under Hittite law could only be bought and sold by Hittites. Avraham comes in and says, Ger v'toshav anochi imachem, not only because this was Avraham's typical humility, right, but because Avraham was simply stating the fact of Hittite law. And that is, that ordinarily, as a Ger v'toshav, he was not entitled to own land in perpetuity. He could rent the land. He could rent it, right? He could have a 99-year lease on it. But he was not entitled to own land in perpetuity. And therefore his plea to the B'nai Chet prior to dealing with Ephraim was not merely for a variance, a zoning variance, but it was in fact a plea for recognition as being their equal before Hittite law, and thereby enabling him to purchase land in perpetuity. As a matter of fact, the terms repeat themselves very significantly in Sefer Vayikra. Are Jews able to own land in perpetuity? No. Va'aretz lo timacher litzmitot ki li chol ha'aretz. Finish the pasuk. Ki geirim v'toshavim atem imadi. Abraham Avinu declares himself to be a ger toshav in full recognition of the fact that this is legal parlance. Legal parlance. Land can only be owned in perpetuity by a full citizen. A ger toshav cannot own land in perpetuity. We are gerim toshavim vis-a-vis God with respect to land in Eretz Yisrael. And Abraham therefore declared himself to be a ger toshav vis-a-vis the Bnei Chayt in terms of the acquisition of the Maharat HaMachpelah. One final piece. One final piece. The third page. I was curious that Midrash of Rabbi Yudan Bar Simon, Zechad Mishlosha Mekomot She'en Umot HaOlam Yecholim Lehonot Et Yisrael, Marat HaMachpelah, the Sadeh in Shechem, and the Goren of Aravna, made me pick up the Tanakh and thumb through it to see whether there are any other similarities between them. And sure enough, there are no negotiations between Yaakov and Shechem over the Sadeh. And in Shmuel, Bet, there are no negotiations between David and Aravna concerning the Goren. But look what I found in Divrei Hayamim Aleph, Perek Kaf Aleph. I found the record of a negotiation between David and Aravna, and lo and behold, when I plotted it out on the right-hand side of the page, I discovered that what it is an adaptation. To me, a very clearly deliberate adaptation of not only the style and the structure, but the very content of Abraham's negotiations with Ephron in order to describe and to illustrate David's negotiations with Aravna. Vayomer David el Ornan, Tna li mekom hagorem, vev nevo mizbeach lashem. You see the parallel passage. Abraham says, Tiga'u li be'Ephron ben Sochar, v'yiten li et me'arat ha'machpelah. Abraham said, "B'chesef malei yitnen mali." David says, "B'chesef malei tenehu li." Ephron responds and says to Abraham three times, "Natati lach b'chane tati anetati halach." Says Ornan to David, "Kachla." I would have much preferred if he had said three times, "Natati lach," but then again, that would be really hitting it over the head instead of making it subtle. And if it had said three times, I'm sure I would not then have become the first person to notice it. Not that I'm imagining that nobody noticed it before. But I looked hard in commentaries on Breshit and on Divrei Hayamim and in books which specialize in this kind of thing. And if anybody saw it before, they didn't take the trouble to say so. And then it continues. And again, by Abraham in Pasuk Yod Gimel, Natati Kesef HaSadeh Kach Mimeni, David in Pasuk HaBalad, Kanoek Nebuchesef Malay, and finally at the end, Abraham pays Abameyot Shekel Kesef, and David, Vayitain David Lornan Bamakom Shiklei Zahav, Mishkal Sheish Meyot. Abraham does what he planned to do with the Mahara, David did what he planned to do with the Goren of Aravna. So what do we find there? We started with several questions. Why does the Torah lavish disproportionate attention on the consequences of Sarah's death? It was because in Abraham's acquisition of the Maharat HaMachpelah that he obtained his first and his first legally recognized foothold in the Promised Land, thereby inaugurating the fulfillment of God's promise. The uncharacteristic narrative prolongation of the negotiations in its various stages, the introduction of these solemn and seemingly long-winded speeches, they serve to increase our participation in the drama, achieving what we described as a total mimetic effect. The particulars of the negotiations serve several purposes simultaneously. On one hand, they advance the mimetic effect. They also testify to the absolute legitimacy of the proceedings in light of what we know of ancient Near Eastern law and subsequent biblical tradition. Abraham's indirect approach to Ephron via the frequently mentioned chitim serves to secure their necessary legal concurrence in the sale, as well, of course, to flatter Ephron and overcome what we presume would be a natural reluctance on his part to sell a piece of his ancestral land. Only in such a way can a ger toshav, a resident alien, ordinarily restricted by law to short-term acquisition, accomplish the purchase of land in perpetuity. Finally, the subtle distinctions between the various forms of Naton and Shemoim Kun serve, as I said, on one hand, to set the tempo of the negotiations and to increase our suspense regarding the motives of the participants of the B'nai Chet. And to that, I would conclude with one last citation from the Yemenite Midrash HaGadol, which read the story and drew its own conclusions about the sincerity of the B'nai Chet, based either on its sensitivity to the text or perhaps their own experiences in Yemen. Bo'u re'ei ma harisha'im osim. Come and look, says the Midrash, at the behavior of evildoers. Omrim harbeh, they'll talk a good lie. Vafilu ma'at ein osim. They don't back it up with deeds. Sharei Ephron amar, listen to Ephron. Hasade natati lach, lecha netatiha, netatiha lach. Shalosh matanot ne'emru kan. 3 times Ephron promised to give Abraham the Na'ara as a gift. Ulevasof, but how does the story end? Over la socher. He pays cash. Shehen hevel, the divrei hen hevel, the chol marase hen hevel. Hevel is an awkward note on which to end, but Chazal remind us that even though Kohelet starts with Hevel and ends with Hevel, they recognize that nevertheless, Chilato Divrei Torah, V'Sofo Divrei Torah, Sof Davar HaKol Nishma. So that really completes what I had intended to share with you this evening. If you have any questions, I would be glad to entertain them. Not at all. You mean the Midrash? I absolutely. As I said, this is the perspective of that Midrash, and as I said, it could be either the product of his reading of the text, or, as I said, it could simply be, instead, a reflection of life in Yemen at that point in time. And as the late Shlomo Dov Goitein has pointed out on numerous occasions, Yemenite Jews are the most Arab of Arabic Jewry. The conditions in Yemen, social conditions anyway, not really having changed much over 2,000 or probably even 3,000 years. So I would certainly take the Midrash with a very, very large grain of salt. And I mean salt as the kind that gets rubbed into an open wound. It's clearly that's what it is, you know, what it is. No, no, no. He's asking for an exception to be made. He's asking for an exception. He's saying, I know, under the law, I'm a ger v'toshav, and I'm entitled only to short-term rentals, but what I am asking you, the B'nai Chayt, before I go to Ephraim to negotiate the specific terms of the sale, I need your acquiescence for the sale to take place at all. And that is why when they say, Nesi Elohim ata b'tochenu, they are effectively responding and saying, yes, Abraham, you have the same rights, you have that right under our law. That we don't know. There isn't nearly enough information to answer that. Even this is mostly speculation based on the little bit of Hittite law which we know. For example, one detail of Hittite law that again seems to confirm not just the authenticity of this story, but that the story is given in such detail in order to confirm it legally, is the fact that mention is made at the end of the story of trees. It says, V'chola etz asher basadeh saviv. What does it matter whether there were or weren't trees? But the one surviving fragment of the Hittite law seems to stipulate that trees either served as boundaries or markers for real estate transactions, or that in fact the status of the field or the price of the field was conditional upon the presence or absence of trees. So really this is drawing conclusions on the basis of evidence rather than citing actual precedent. The same relationship that there is between the laws of Hammurabi and Parshat Mishpatim, meaning there seems to have been to a certain extent a common legal ethos in the ancient Near East, which is reflected in the specific legal codes of every different civilization. Nevertheless, kishem she'en partzufehem shel bnei adam shavim kachen de'otehem shavot. There is a common, may have been a common legal ethos in the ancient Near East, but that doesn't mean that all ancient Near Eastern laws were the same or identical. There were still differences. Yeah. I try to be very careful in my use of ambiguity and ambivalence. If something can be read in two different ways, it's ambivalent. If something is obscure or perplexing, then it becomes entirely ambiguous. The purpose of ambiguity, I believe that that all the books of Tanakh, all the authors of Tanakh, engaged in deliberate ambiguity, and the most reasonable and effective function of ambiguity is to draw the reader into the text, to make the reader participate actively in deciphering the text. I even once sat down and read Empson on the seven types of ambiguity in order to understand what the Torah of ambiguity is. But as I said, I think I was talking about the deliberate side of the ambiguity. Yes, it is to open possibilities. It certainly is consistent with the notion of Shivim Panim LaTorah, or the notion even something that Komasha Tamid Vatik Ativ LaChadesh, right, that the Torah, that inherent in the Torah.
I wasn't referring to those directions. I know you said directions even within,
yes,
Tanakh,
yes,
within the
Peshat. Yes, absolutely. But that I think is more a function of ambivalence than of ambiguity. I think that the function of ambiguity is to draw you in. In fact, in certain cases, even to sucker you in, to becoming involved in the interpretation. Beyond which there are also terms that are ambivalent, and they're the ones that offer the alternatives of specific interpretation.
Right, but on the B'nai Chayt's motivation, you have no idea where they're coming from. What would you call that?
As I said, but you do have some idea. We said that this is not, they're not unknown to us. Abraham has a prior relationship with them. and therefore we not only may, but perhaps we even must presume on that prior relationship. Avraham came back from the Milchama with the spoils of Sodom, Amorah, Admah, and Tzivoyim, and when the king of Sodom said, "Tein li hanefesh v'haruchosh tachlach," Avraham wonderfully said, "Imichod v'atzroch mal," but he also said, "Biladai, rak asher yochlu ha'anashim, yochlu ha'ne'arim v'chelak ha'anashim asher halchulti, aner eshkol u'mamre hen yitlu chelka." This is the land of aner eshkol and mamre. So there's a relationship there which we not only may but even must presume on. So we would be entirely justified in reading the text that these are completely honorable people who want to do right by the man they hold in esteem as in the Nasi Elohim, and not see it through the troubled and often tormented eyes of a later Midrash. But nevertheless, that's part of the beauty of the text, is that by encouraging you to participate in its interpretation, it's validating your experience, as a legitimate means or basis for interpretation. And that effect is a reasonable hypothesis of current literary investigation of the Bible. And that is that anyone with an established competence in the language of the text may in fact presume to draw upon his own experience as a legitimate means of interpreting it. And that's even without getting into deconstructionism.
I'm going to
As I said, we have no way to know. I've seen arguments both on both sides, but the consensus of opinion which I respect says that there is no way of telling. Maybe understand it differently. Maybe he's saying that I'm only asking you. Maybe he's trying to show Abraham that he's given him a good deal, and he's saying, "I only ask you if it really amounts to a symbolic price." But Ephraim doesn't want to be seen as taking advantage of a man in his mourning. I mean, how would it look if Ephraim, if people write letters saying, "Ephraim, poor that Ephraim, you should have seen him. He was this poor guy. Here's his dead wife right in front of him. Et meti milafanai. Here's his dead wife lying there. And Ephraim is trying to, you'll forgive me for this awful, awful term, and Ephraim is trying to Jew him." Right? So Ephraim wants to make sure that everybody standing around understands that this Abba Meir Shekel Kesef is a mafi. There's a legitimate reason for that. Okay, we resume next Tuesday night.
Right, the next Tuesday.
Yeah.
So next 2 weeks
will be on Tuesday nights.
And then we're